You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Jamie Dumont.
I'm Rob Russo.
And this is
The Fabulous Invalid.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, the girls are away. Leslie is wrapping up previews on, by the time this airs, they will have opened.
Oh, very exciting.
As everybody knows, the curtain is off the closet. That's not a saying, is it?
I don't think so.
I just made that up. But basically, you know, we're like a week or two behind, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you know, yeah.
And Jennifer is actually probably gearing to go on stage as we speak.
As we speak, yeah. Ooh.
But hi, what's going on?
Well, we had an amazing evening last night at the opening night of Hadestown. And again, this is a couple weeks later, but I'm still kind of like...
It'll still be running in this air.
It will definitely still be running if I have anything to do about it, say about it. Oh my gosh, it was just such an incredible, special evening. I, you know, put in a plug to all of our listeners to get tickets for Hadestown.
And maybe even try the mezzanine. Which is where we sat.
Yes, we were in the mezzanine.
You know, I'm a bit of a snob about where I sit.
Yes.
And I sometimes get cranky when I look at my locations and they have me in the mezzanine. But there are certain shows that really do, I think the term is a mezzanine show.
Right.
They look great in the mezzanine.
Yeah.
Hadestown looks great
everywhere.
Now everywhere in the theater, I've come to learn.
Yeah. And I will say, the coolest thing from my experience with Hadestown is I went to see it in London last fall at the Royal National Theater. And have now seen it on Broadway. And it's at the Walter Kerr Theater on Broadway, which is one of the smallest houses. It's usually a playhouse. It's rarely used for musicals because of its intimacy and, you know, the size of the stage and the relationship between the mezzanine and the stage. And in London, it was at the National Theater in the Olivier, which is huge. It's, you know, if you've never been, it's sort of like the Vivian Beaumont at Lincoln Center. It's got a giant apron stage. It's very wide, no proscenium, very modern, very clean, very sleek. And seeing the show, which is, it's a small show, you know, 7-member band, probably a cast around a dozen folks. Seeing the show at the National Theater in this giant house and on Broadway in this very intimate space completely transformed the experience. Same show. I mean, you know, they've
same principal
cast.
Some of the dancers are different, right?
The ensemble's all different and the fates are different. The same five principal characters. And obviously, you know, they tweak the show between London and New York. But the experience of seeing it, even in the mezzanine at the Walter Kerr, which is not a bad seat in that in that theater.
First of all, the Kerr is a fabulous theater.
It's gorgeous.
And I know I say that about everything.
You do.
But the mezzanine is very forward in that theater. And it's very steep. The rake is very... I mean, you saw me falling up the stairs several times last night. Which, if anybody hasn't ever fallen up a set of stairs, it does take work. It's an effort to fall up a set of stairs.
It's a testament to the fact that, you know, you can have the best show, but if it's not in the right theater, you know, it makes a difference.
It does.
Well, I'm excited to talk to our guest this week.
Our first director.
We've gotten this far in the season without
Without a, well, Warren has directed.
And Joel Grey has directed.
And Joel Grey has directed. But they're both, Joel is known primarily as a performer right. and an actor. And
Warren's a choreographer.
Warren's known,
known for his choreography.
So this is a gentleman by the name of Des Makinoff. Des Makinoff is the first true director by trade and
yeah.
quite a prolific right. director at that.
Right, yeah.
So this is quite a treat.
Yeah, I'm excited.
And I'm a big fan of How to Succeed, of Jersey Boys.
His body of work is, yeah.
Ain't Too Proud,
yeah,
which
yeah.
I love on many levels. So this is a treat.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, it's like he said, I'm an outdoor girl. Living it, up. Married to the king of the underworld. Living it up on top.
Today, we are honored to welcome two-time Tony Award-winning director Des Makinoff. With over three decades of smash hits, including The Who's Tommy, How to Succeed in Business, Jersey Boys, and this season's Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations, Des has also served as artistic director of both the La Jolla Playhouse and Stratford Festival. Des, welcome to The Fabulous Invalid.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So I just have to clear my conscience before we start.
Please, you did something to me.
I did, and I think I owe you some money.
Uh-oh.
When I first moved to New York in 1995, I second acted How to Succeed so many times. Back in the day when
you could.
Could second act something. And I sat in the balcony, well, not the balcony, but the way back of the mezzanine
right.
of the Rogers Theater.
Right.
So no one would detect me, usually on a Tuesday or a Thursday night, which was always a good night for that. So I feel like I owe you some lost royalties.
Listen, thank you so much. You know, I would have definitely escorted you into your seat and sat beside you. And yeah, I loved getting to do that. And they're great teachers. You know, you do these old musicals or classical plays, and, you know, you learn so much from people that are long gone just by studying their texts. And one of the things that about that show that one discovers, and it's the key to understanding how to stage it, is that there is not a single sincere moment in that entire show. And everybody has to seem like they're being truthful, but no one ever is. Everyone has an agenda. Mm-hmm. And that really works, you know, brilliantly. And if you start to slide into any kind of sentimentality, or, you know, you make anybody even remotely sincere, it collapses like a house of cards. So as long as you continue to, you know, keep that as your sort of mantra, then the show sort of leads you along. You know, it was interesting. Wayne Salenta, who I collaborated with, is brilliant at doing comedic choreography, which is not something he was necessarily known for, but we did a production of Forum as well, which he was also spectacular at doing, you know, and he would use steps from Follies, you know, for the four guys, and I wish I could demonstrate to
rest more
than just you. Thank you.
Did very well.
So he had this great comedic you know, vocabulary. He's very, very funny with movement, which is not so easy to do. Key with Matthews, we did it in La Jolla before we remounted it at the Kennedy Center. And Matthew is not a real dancer, and I want to point out, nor am I. So I have every right to say that, because I say it with deep sympathy. And so I can stage numbers, but I always need, you know, the choreographer to do the steps. I love staging numbers, as I suppose is obvious. The thing is, when we realized that Matthew could do, you know, certain things, and certain things he did wonderfully well, just in terms of his, you know, movement. He's like, you know, he has that Jack Benny timing and so on. And so when we redid the production, Wayne very cleverly used Matthew's movement style as the basis for much of the choreography, particularly his choreography. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it worked a treat. So he kind of looked like Fred Astaire up there, but he was just doing what he could do. And all of the other dancers, many of whom were actually, you know, quite brilliant, just fell into step with Matthew. So that show was a blast. And, you know, I have people like Jeff Blumenkrantz and, you know, Jonathan Freeman, who is, you know, a brilliant musical knows far more about musical comedy than I ever hoped to.
Gentlemen, a secretary is not a toy. No, my boy, not a toy to fondle and dandle and playfully handle in search of some puerile joy. No! A secretary is not, definitely not, a toy.
So moving forward a couple of years into the now, congratulations on the smash success of Ain't Too Proud.
Thank you so much.
It's really such a remarkable evening in the theater. Mm. And I wonder, there are people that may be looking at this as a bookend to Jersey Boys, and I think there's a misperception out there that you're a jukebox musical guy, which is not true.
I'm so pleased that you're saying that.
Well, this is the third one you've done, and that's how great. Many other shows have you directed? 100? 200?
Between Jersey Boys and Ain't Too Proud, and I know this because my assistant Megan Dieterle volunteered to do this. I've actually directed 27 productions since Jersey Boys, and only three of them have been so-called jukebox or catalog or biography, you know, musicals. Summer, the Donna Summer production, and Jersey Boys and Ain't Too Proud inclusive, and that's it. I mean, in fact, I think I've done something like, if this is right, I think I've done seven classics, six by Shakespeare, and two of those productions, by the way, starring the great Christopher Plummer, who's also a wonderful not only actor but teacher and partner. So yeah, actually, I think in all other genres, classic musicals, new plays and new musicals with new scores, I think I've done more productions than three in all of those categories. But you know what happens, and it's understandable, is if a show gets a lot of visibility or you're lucky enough to have it proliferate, and some of those other shows, by the way, I've done multiple times too, but nothing quite like, Jersey Boys. So when you see it, enough three sheets or whatever, then, obviously, people assume that that's kind of what you do. And I'm very proud of those shows, please don't get me wrong, but I think I would be, I couldn't just do one genre. You know, I'm my career is much too confused. And, I look at the next bright, shiny object, and I want, the thing about being a director, not unlike, by the way, journalism, but it's sort of a dilettante's paradise, because you really get to move into a new solar system without necessarily even being all that knowledgeable about it. I mean, you have to obviously study like crazy and come out the other end with a real working knowledge of the subject. But, people allow you to, drop back into, 11th century Scotland without necessarily a degree in history, and so you want to take full advantage of that and keep leaping from, you know, lily pad to lily pad. And so that's been, you know, the way I've been running my so-called career.
Well, that so-called career, as you just said, I believe you started out wanting to be a playwright. Is that right?
You know, I still actually write, and I started off, enters even deeper into the land of my confusion. But I started off writing songs, writing and composing music. And I started that when I was very, very young. I was very young. I mean, I wasn't like Mozart, and I certainly couldn't compose like him either. But I started writing when I was about 14. And I did a couple of high school musicals like everybody else. And, you know, I actually did, you know, the Fosse number in Pajama Game, Steam Heat, without dancing it, by the way. Just sang there and, you know, sang it with black tights on. And so then, you know, Hair came along, and I would have been about 17 and came to Toronto. And there were, and I just, what Hair kind of taught me is that there was music that was like the music I was listening to and playing, you know, as in bands. Everybody, by the way, in the late 60s was in a rock and roll band, everybody, or an R&B band. And you just had to be. There was no choice, you know. you know, and so I'd been doing that. And so when Hair came along, I kind of applied my rather feeble knowledge of you know, musicals with the music that I loved, and I composed a show. So I started as with music and then got into writing. And at a certain point, as a writer, I wanted to write plays. And so even here in the city, going back to my public theater days, I wrote plays. Joe Papp, you know, supported my writing, and I came to him as a writer. I wrote a play called Leave It to Beaver Is Dead with Diane Wiest and Mandy Patinkin and Brent Spiner, wonderful company. And Joe was always fond of writers and suspicious of directors. And so it was great that I came to him as a writer, because when I started directing for him, he still would put his hand on my shoulder and treat me with great affection. Yeah. So I did back into directing, yeah, which is the way I think most of us arrive here.
So the public was where you started directing, or you had?
I directed in Canada a little bit. And, I realized at a certain point that directors seemed to be able to get projects on. And with playwrights, you know, you had to kind of submit your work. And while it was a very vibrant scene in Toronto, you know, and I don't even know if I'm being completely truthful with you, because I think the bottom line is that writing involves a lot of solitude, and directing is social. Mm. And it's simply, until opening night, you know, more fun. You know, you're with people, you know, you get to have conversations and get to know people, whereas, you know, writing, you spend so much time on your own, lonely, depressed, calling your therapist. So directing's just more stimulating.
With Ain't Too Proud, when you were out of town with three cities before coming to New York, is that correct?
Yeah, well, if you include Berkeley, I think it's actually even four.
Yes,
yeah.
That's mm-hmm. correct. Yes, I'm forgetting about Berkeley. So is there, when you have such a long out-of-town period, is there some sort of, is there more pressure, or is it more relief because you know you have time to work on things?
I would again say there's no recipe. You know, I think every canvas, you know, requires a certain amount of time to paint and to, you know, if you're going to put more coats on, you need to wait for that paint to dry, and it can be, you know, you can sometimes move very quickly, and you're working on impulses and sort of intuition, and that can be really great. I think with Tom, the Who's Tommy, a thing that I had the privilege of working with Pete Townsend of The Who on, you know, we were actually working from liner notes, and I'm not exaggerating.
Off the album?
Off the album. That's how the script got created. And I was storyboarding, moving liner notes around, and then filling in, you know, stage directions, and it's mainly sung through, and, you know, he would help me rewrite a few of the lyrics here and there. I'd make suggestions, and we kept doing that. We were, that was probably February, and we were in casting by April and in rehearsal in June. And so that was just a few months, and we went from La Jolla to New York, and I'm making some changes in New York, but relatively minor. You know, we mainly got it. And that was just, you know, I was in a band when I was 17, and I remember being with our roadie, who guy I still know, Dennis, at his place. We were rehearsing in, you know, his basement, and listening to this album he just bought, and probably smoking something. And so I think a lot of what was in my head for that production, obviously it was in Pete's blood, but a lot of what was in my head came from listening to that album as a 17-year-old. So working fast was important. It was a little bit Jackson Pollock. And Jackson Pollock, by the way, that's a total misnomer. So if anybody thinks that Jackson Pollock simply threw paint at a canvas, they're incredibly naive, because that came after, you know, a lot of technique. So I don't say that in a disparaging way. But sometimes plugging into your gut and your imagination, there's something dreamlike about moving quickly and trusting it. And in other cases, it's more cerebral. I think with Ain't Too Proud, the time really was valuable. Now, I think we were probably ready fairly early when we went to Toronto. I think we all felt, Dominique, Sergio, Trujillo, we all felt like, you know, we pretty much muscled through a lot of the problem areas, and we probably, if you know, a theater had, you know, become available earlier, or we knew we had it, maybe we would have taken one step, you know, moved one step earlier. But it was a pretty good route, I've got to say, and we weren't idle. We continued to, you know, try to refine the piece, and it's a very good self-critical team. So there was plenty of work. I wouldn't want to do it on every show. You know, I'd only have two or three left in me if that were the case, for one thing. So I think sometimes I think you have to be sensitive to the rhythm. You know, the theater exists, as you know, and as quoting Bob Dylan, in the eternal present. And so if you don't tap into the fact that on some level it's real life, then, you know, go make a movie. Right. You know, it is real life. And so you have to, I think, be sensitive to, you know, as you do a play, you're aging, and so are the actors, you know. So if you wait too long, you know, Juliet's, you know, not right for the part.
That's amazing. Well, speaking of that, in 1993, you said, what threatens the Broadway musical more than anything is they're difficult to develop.
I don't know if you remember saying
that.
I don't remember saying
that on Charlie.
A long time ago. Yeah. Did I really?
And I'm wondering, you know, given that we've just had a discussion about, you know,
yeah, sure,
ways that musicals develop, has that changed, or do you still feel that way?
You know, I think in some ways things have gotten a little bit better. In 92, 93, is that 92, did you say?
I think it was 93.
93, yeah, okay. So we were, you know, we did a show at La Jolla called Big River in 85. And I should also give ACT credit there, because they did an earlier version of it that was perhaps more of a play with songs, and then it developed more into a musical, Big River, the, you know, adaptation of Huckleberry Finn.
I did it in high school.
Did you really?
I did.
What did you play?
I was... No,
the river.
Right. No, of course now I'm forgetting the character name. One of the two.
Tom Sawyer or Norman.
No, there was a.
Oh, you played the Duke or the King.
Yes, I was the Duke.
You played the Duke, I think that's probably good casting. I don't think you'd. I don't think you'd be right for the King.
There you go.
It's a great. René Auberjonois played that part on Broadway and was wonderful.
She's got one big breast in the middle of her chest and an eye in the middle of her nose. So says I, if you look her in the eye, you're better off looking up her nose.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
In 1985, when we did that production, it was very unusual for those who worked in the halls of commerce and those who worked in the not-for-profit to partner. Mm-hmm. And there had reached this point, I think, where people in the commercial theater were waiting for product to be developed in the not-for-profit. And the not-for-profit theaters by that point, a lot of them had become maybe a little bit lazy, not all of them, by the way, some wonderful theaters, but some of them were waiting for Broadway product. Mm. So you were doing the play that had happened two seasons before on Broadway when the rights became available, and you were doing that for your community and so on. Okay, perfectly good, but as musicals became more and more expensive, they just weren't getting developed. You know, you couldn't go on the road. We did it with Ain't Too Proud, but it's unusual. You know, in the old days, they would go to Washington or they'd go to Baltimore or they'd go to New Haven and they'd try it out and they wouldn't lose their shirts, hopefully doing it. But that had become very expensive. And so, there was this kind of thing started, and La Jolla Playhouse was part of the inception of that system where musicals would be, kind of developed in partnership. And I think that's become quite successful. There are dangers. The not-for-profit can become hooked on the enhancement funds. And so instead of looking for the next brilliant play by Tony Kushner or someone else, Dominique Morisseau, you're looking for the next musical that comes with enhancement. Mm-hmm. And that's the path to mediocrity, of course. And then on the musical side, you can also, or on the commercial side, I think sometimes people want to kind of get in and bully the not-for-profits as if it's already their show, when they're actually working, hopefully, as guests in, you know, the auspices of a not-for-profit organization. Mm. But if you keep all of those principles straight and clear, then they can be fruitful, you know, relationships. And if you look at many of the shows that are on Broadway now, they came through some sort of process, the Public Theater, you know, under Oscar Eustace, or through Christopher Ashley at La Jolla Playhouse, they kind of worked their way and developed, and they had the kind of runway that it requires to get, you know, a B-52 bomber right off the ground, and that's what a musical is, you know. Sure. So I think things are, not to be a Pollyanna, but I think there has been success, some real substantial success in terms of developing musicals.
But it seems like it takes longer now to develop a musical. It seems like the path for a musical is 7 or 8 years, sometimes longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, in the 80s and 90s and, well, let's just stay with that.
The golden age.
Well, but the time we're talking about when you first made this comment, I think that it was a much shorter path.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting how things may be more fruitful, but it's a much longer process.
I think it, again, depends on the show. You know, again, Jersey Boys moved very quickly. Once again, with Rick Ellis, who was your guest, I was meeting with them and we were, I believe the script was still being written. That was a very quirky process because I was artistic director. I could put the show in production before it was finished. I was so confident that we really had a tiger by the tail that we announced the play and it was still being written. And we were I was with Clara Ziglarova, the designer for that, and we were literally designing that production. And they were coming over having not finished the writing. We had an outline. And so we were cross-pollinating like, you know, in a furious fashion. And that so that happened really fast. We were in rehearsal in August. And so it was less than a year. Back in the golden age, and I wasn't being facetious, going back to the, you know, if you're 1952 and you're Frank Lesser, you know, at that time, first of all, I think the physical productions were less ambitious because, you know, you were dealing with, and there were some beautiful designs, but they were, everything was somewhat simpler. Lighting, obviously, you know, stage technology has developed so much since those days and is more complex and requires more preparation. But also everybody lived within 10 blocks of, you know, they all lived in the same neighborhood. So if you wanted a copyist, they were across the street, or your orchestrator lived next door and they were banging the piano at 3 a.m. on the song you'd just written. Or, you know, it was a real, you know, industry. One of the things that I think has again, that's working against what you're talking about, the fact that they're complicated, is just everything that's happened with communication. You know, now people can Skype. And so you don't necessarily have to all, you know, be in the same neighborhood to create together. You know, people have found ways, and you're doing it every day, I'm sure, too, you know, to communicate long distances. So, you know, I think there are, I think maybe ebbs and flows in terms of the speed, you know, of production.
Well, and it's also a double-edged sword, right? Because what you're saying about the golden age, where it was a simpler time and the lighting and the sound and all of that was easier or it was less sophisticated, therefore sort of easier to produce. Nowadays, particularly in musical theater, mm-hmm. where everything is so everything's so advanced, mm-hmm. there's also the issue that it's hard to make changes, right? Because if you have a short window in a rehearsal process or whatever that is, you're limited, I assume, in how much time you have when everything is so complicated and
mechanized,
yeah. Right? So your hands must be tied a little bit as a director, and I would think that would be a little frustrating.
You know, I actually, in honesty, don't find that. I think that there's still a fluidity in terms of, you know, one's ability to make changes, and you know, I think if you plan properly. You know, for example, I like to generally spend no fewer than 5 weeks in the room. I prefer in previews to not have matinees so we can continue to make changes. So I actually, and you know, some of the things that take time, they were struggled with in 1953 too. If you're putting a new song in, you've got to restage it.
Right.
You got to do a new orchestration. So the first time you're performing that new song, it's off a piano vocal. And the audience, you hope, doesn't notice that suddenly the orchestra isn't playing and some poor guy's or woman is banging out a piano, you know, part under a song. So I think they've always been kind of hideously complicated. I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, our perception, you know, again, we do our work on the shifting sands of time. And so if you were to go back, I think, to 1953, and you were listening to a show that didn't have any amplification, and where you had to have the strings playing when, you know, somebody was singing their solo verse, and they probably were having to bellow at the top of their lungs to hit the back row of the balcony, and they were literally shouting the dialogue across the stage, it would be a somewhat foreign experience. because, you know, and film has affected us and television since those days. Hard to believe, but television was brand new in the early 50s. So, you know, we expect a certain kind of verisimilitude, a different kind of performance style. You know, we've grown used to that. So it's interesting that some of these technologies, I think, are necessary in order to deliver an emotional experience to an audience. And this is a really boring rant I'm on, so I'll cut it short in a second. I'll cut it off. But, you know, that's true of the wireless microphone. The wireless microphone was actually created at the Delacorte for Shakespeare in the Park. The wireless microphone was created for verse drama.
I did not know that.
And for a long time, we were limited to a certain number of frequencies. So you had to go to the shotgun mics, which are general mics along the front. You know what those are, of course. And so when you went to dialogue, you went to the shotguns. And so inevitably what happened is the book scene tended to recede. And so you tried to compensate for that. You would, if you had underscoring, you'd kick it up a step. And you perk up the tempo, so you try to lift into the book scene. But by the 70s or so, you were seeing more and more sung through musicals, fewer and fewer book musicals. There was a big thing, oh, the book musical is dead. And I think that had everything to do with the wireless microphone.
Oh, that's
when when we had enough wireless microphones that we could mic everybody, then book scenes had the same importance in a show in terms of audio as music and sound. And you saw the book scene coming back to life. So while we're very suspicious of technology in the theater, you know, I guarantee when Shakespeare's company moved into the Blackfriars, people were shouting at each other about natural light.
Right.
How can you possibly do these plays without natural light, without the sunshine? You know, how can you possibly use, you know, candles or gasoline, you know, and every time something new comes along, people are shrieking. They're so upset, you know. What happened to the natural voice, you know, in the musicals? Well, you know, I don't know if you heard the natural voice, you know, somebody again, just like a moose just having to try to fill the entire house. Maybe it wouldn't be as you know great as you think. And on the other hand, I think technology can smother, and if it's not used properly, that it can interfere with the spoken word and with, you know, an emotional performance. So I think you also have to be very careful that one, you know, you don't render the actors to automatons.
And that's your function. That's all under your purview, is to make sure that all of these things balance out.
And I think it's also important to remember that, you know, I mean, this is true in everything, but, you know, as a director, you really do want the group to come up with the ideas, and you as much as possible. And frankly, if they're not, you want to create the illusion that they are. You know, the trick with holding the gavel is never using it.
Right. Mm.
And that's particularly true of direction. And when you're a young director, and I speak for myself, I think you do tend to want to be more controlling. You know, you think, and it's human nature, that if you're not making the decisions or appearing to be in command, then somehow you're weak. And of course, the exact opposite is true. It's when you're, you know, when you're actually really listening to your colleagues and mining their great ideas, that's when you're at your most powerful.
Because isn't that the point of assembling your creative team? I mean, you want to surround yourself with people that you trust and whose work you want to help foster and all make something great.
Yes,
isn't that the key? Is what you're saying?
Yeah, that's dead right, and I honestly think that's 90% of the job. It's when you're inviting people to the table, whether it's, you know, designers, whoever. If you happen to come onto a project before the writer or writers, then that's critical to make sure you're inviting the best people to your tea party and people that you can really work with. And absolutely true with actors. I mean, I don't care how good you think you are as an actor, if you have someone who's either miscast are not capable of delivering a performance, there's nothing you're going to be able to do. I mean, you know, you can enhance, you can coach, you can even teach some in rehearsal, but it's mainly about the talent and the skill that an actor has. That's really what it's about. And that's one of the reasons you end up taking more and more time casting. And Tara Rubin, I've been working with Tara, I won't tell you for how long, because she'll kill me. She'll kill us both. But we go through a really arduous process. And one of the things I love about Tara is that, and I also have tried to do this myself, but she's really good at getting people to feel comfortable, because when they walk into that space, you know, you want people to do their best work. So you want a warm, safe environment. And so with Tara, I'm always sure that I'm seeing the best an actor, you know, pretty much can do, or I'm gonna see them in a good light. Because you're right, you do not want to make a mistake. You I don't care how smart you think you are, you can't, you know, if you don't have the right crew, the right team on the field, you're not gonna win the Super Bowl. That's for sure.
And you said a moment ago that you like to get out of the room after 5 weeks, no longer than 5 weeks. And what's the, I mean, I think this is an obvious question, but what's the value of getting into the theater? What changes? What happens that's not in the room?
Yeah, I probably was not representing that of the way I meant or the way intended. You know, I want as much. I'm a greedy little pig. I want as much rehearsal time as you're going to give me. And 5 weeks in the studio is generally considered a kind of a generous mm-hmm. amount of time. I mean, I've actually spent 6 weeks on occasion in the studio. That's pretty rare. And then, you know, 2 weeks of tech. No, I'm actually very happy to be in the studio within reason for as long as possible. I mean,
does it get stale after a while?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I mean, you go through a period, particularly on a comedy, as you know, where you forget that it's funny.
Right.
And so, and one of the things I've directed a couple of solo shows, one with the great Christopher Plummer, one with Billy Crystal, and one of the things that's, you know, you think, oh, a one-man show, cool, you know, I don't have to stage any production numbers, you know, this is great, there's not like massive amounts of people to share dramaturgical notes with, you know, this is going to be great. And then you get in there and you realize that sometimes you're the only person in the room. It's you, the actor, the stage manager, and you better laugh.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like it's going to be like and fortunately with both those two actors, Billy Crystal is endlessly funny, as is Chris. So I think it's about everybody in the room finding a rhythm together, and you know, I think that's the real key to, you know, to working the clock.
It's a good key to life, isn't it?
That's true, because I guess it's all going to run out. You know, I plan to live forever. So far, so good.
Plan.
You know? Yeah. But that's true. It is a key to life. Yeah. And that's actually, I think you just said a mouthful, because it's amazing how I think when people get off track in what we do, they lose their common sense. And there's a lot of pressure sometimes, and a lot of judgment, and sometimes mean-spiritedness, you know, and that gets us forgetting to apply, you know, the things that as you just said, that have to do with just real life, you know, treating people with respect and, you know, and again, creating a world that's safe for them to work in and so on.
Sometimes the simplest things are the hardest things to accomplish.
Yeah, I think often that's the case. Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah.
Well, speaking of finding a rhythm, you very famously revived the La Jolla Playhouse in 1983 and served two different stints as artistic director, really putting that institution on the map as one of the leading incubators for new work in America. As you look back on that experience, and you reflect upon it, What are you proudest of in terms of your work there?
First of all, you know way too much, and I'm flattered to have you say that because, you know, that's a very good question. Let me see how I can evade it. I want to say that I think of all the things I've had the privilege to be involved in, you know, my role in, you know, La Jolla Playhouse is my most important achievement. And so, and I take nothing away from Michael Greif and Christopher Ashley have been great artistic directors. Ann Hamburger was there for a time too. But I feel like that really was, you know, happening to create a sandbox where others could create, you know, their sandcastles. Mm. That's a really, you know, that's something I'm very, very, you know, proud of. And of course, they are sandcastles, so the wind comes along and the rain, and they do vanish into the mists of time. But I believe that La Jolla has become, this is a word that's often thought of negatively, but I think it's become an institution. And that word to me implies permanence. Mm-hmm. It's not about bureaucracy. It's right. Something that will live on, I hope, for years to come. That's the thing that, by the way, for me was the key to understanding the Temptations. And the reason I embraced the project, other than the fact that Otis Williams asked me to, and he is he's 6'5", and you're not going to say no to him when he said, Otis says, I want you to do this place. Okay, yeah. I'm happy to do that. And I love him, by the way. But one of the things that I saw in him, in Otis, that I respect so much and admire so much is that he created an institution, mm-hmm. an institution that achieved change, you know, in America. And so that's why Ain't Too Proud is about, and Dominique saw similar things in the story. So that's one of the reasons that we've, I think, made the show about entrances and exits.
And consistency. Know? I think that's something that your show illustrates beautifully. And part of the success of the Temptations, the consistency of Otis Williams and his right. commitment to keeping it always going under any cost. And you, the show illustrates that beautifully.
And I think that's the whole is larger than the sum of its parts, which is a major theme. You know, people can come and go, but it's that entity, that institution that's right. ultimately important. And I think that is how I try to look at La Jolla, yeah. that it's not about a single production. Right. It's about a body of work, and it's not about a single artist. It's about a group of artists. And, you know, this may be a little esoteric, but we did The Seagull back in 1985, and it was really a revelation for me. I directed the production, and The Seagull is lots of things. It's obviously an incredible achievement and maybe in some ways the first kind of modern play, but at the pit of its soul, it's a microcosm for an art scene. And you have all of these characters whose souls have been shaped by a different genre of art. Mm. And they all fall in love with each other, but they can't communicate because they come from different genres. You know, Constantine is a symbolist. You know, Nina is an actress of wants to be an actress of tragedy. You know, Trigorin's a certain kind of short story writer. Arkadin is a melodramatic actress of a particular period. They all, and it's not whether they're good artists or bad artists. It's about the fact that they've had their lives so deeply affected by a genre. And it's like, you know, what happens if a punk rocker falls in love with somebody who's comes from big band? You know, they have a really hard time communicating. And that was really a key production for the Playhouse, and also in terms of our understanding and acceptance of the eclecticism of the American theater, that we wanted that place to be about good, not about a particular genre. We wanted it to be about good work. And so we welcomed Bill Irwin, and Sondheim was there very early on, and artists that came from Amanda Plummer and, you know, Emily Mann, and people that came from very different aesthetic, you know, viewpoints. And I'm very proud of that. The La Jolla seems as an institution to be capable of supporting a whole host of artists that may have completely contrasting styles. But to me, that's the joy and achievement of the American theater.
Well, on that note, I have to say thank you. There's nothing else to say.
You summed it up perfectly.
Thank you for coming down. I mean, I think I can now say you're an institution.
Oh,
taken as a compliment.
Exactly. We always do have one last question.
We do.
Yes.
Great.
I think you answered it, but go ahead and ask it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, what is the show or experience that you had early on in your life that sort of hooked you on the theater?
Oh my heavens, that's a really tough one. You know, there was a small theater in Toronto, and it was a very young theater scene. And I had decided, you know, I'd written a couple of musicals by that point, and I was starting to write plays. But it was a theater called Toronto Free Theater, and they did a number of wonderful plays, and they would have one of the director would direct the writer's work, and then the next play, the writer would be directing the director's writing. And, you know, it was just this fantastic company. And one of the plays they did was a kind of an Orton-esque farce called The End. And I just remember thinking, you know, what a spectacular group of you know, artists. And I got commissioned by that theater, I was only 20 shortly after that. And that was a real life changer, you know, was just seeing that play and then trying to work with those people. That changed, you know, everything for me. And I still think about that group, you know, and I'm inspired by them.
Wonderful. Well, I think it's fair to say we're both inspired by you.
Oh,
thank you so much for coming down and chatting with us.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg and plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, because you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, as you know it. Please don't leave me, girl. Don't you go.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. We just finished our conversation with Des McAnuff, who, in addition to his contributions to the theater as director and producer, served as artistic director of two major institutions, La Jolla Playhouse in California, as we talked about, and the Stratford Festival in Southern Ontario. While The Fabulous Invalid refers to Broadway, a secondary mission of this podcast, as we give a 360-degree view of the industry, is to highlight other theaters across America as well, from Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia, to the Curran Theater in San Francisco. After all, great theater is happening everywhere, not just in New York and London. If you've never personally been, you've still likely heard of La Jolla Playhouse, and you may be wondering about this celebrated regional outpost that bills itself as a place where artists and audiences come together to create what's new and next in American theater. Founded in 1947 by actors Gregory Peck, Dorothy McGuire, and Mel Ferrer, La Jolla Playhouse was created as a summer stock retreat for Hollywood luminaries to flex their stage acting muscles. So many actors working in Los Angeles long to get back on a legitimate stage, which was strangely absent in the City of Angels. So Gregory Peck looked a little over 100 miles south to his hometown of La Jolla to create an outlet for their desire. With some seed money from producer David Selznick, the troupe was born. In its original incarnation, greats like Vivian Vance, Groucho Marx, Ginger Rogers, Vincent Price, Eartha Kitt, and Eve Arden, among others, all made appearances in La Jolla's summer productions. After over a decade of success, the company began to decline, though, and shuttered after Zsa Zsa Gabor's infamous performance in Bly's Spirit in 1964. Dreams of a new permanent theater, though, never died, despite an extended hiatus until 1982. That's when Des McAnuff stepped in to revive the company at its new home on the campus of UC San Diego in 1983, fulfilling the vision that Gregory Peck had imagined some 25 years prior of transitioning his little summer stock troupe into a serious, permanent theatrical powerhouse on the West Coast. Under Dez's leadership from 1983 to 1994, and again from 2001 to 2007, La Jolla became just that, fast emerging as a preeminent incubator for new and exciting work, developing dozens of plays and musicals, among them Big River, The Who's Tommy, and Jersey Boys, all directed by Dez and all transferring to Broadway for successful runs. In 1993, after only 10 years in its reconstituted form, La Jolla was awarded the prestigious Tony Award for Outstanding Regional Theater. Director Christopher Ashley took over when Dez left in 2007, continuing his tradition of originating new work, including the hit musicals Memphis and Come From Away. Indeed, to date, La Jolla has mounted 101 world premieres, commissioned 52 new works, and sent 32 productions to Broadway, which have collectively earned a total 38 Tony Awards. In the absence of a national theater or any serious federal support for the arts, regional theaters in America have become the places where plays and musicals are given the space and the resources that they need to develop. And La Jolla is an important star in that constellation. Rob here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.